usual this morning. We may have some others come in, but we may have a little shorter crowd this morning than we usually do with the weather as it is outside. I did hear something coming out that sort of impressed on me that presence or absence at any event may be determined by our commitment. This afternoon they'll play the NFC Championship game in Green Bay this morning. The temperature is going to be way down. The wind chill factor is going to be around 20 below. And I guarantee you that stadium will be absolutely filled. Except for one seat, one man who has season tickets on the 50-yard line said he was leaving one of them empty in memory of Vince Lombardi. And his wisdom in guiding that team to a number of championships.
If Vince shows up, there's going to be a lot of empty seats around him.
I dare say that's true. I dare say that's true. At least this one has some meaning. It's not like Jerry Glanville looking for Elvis. We are ready for chapter 33 of the book of Job. Last Lord's Day, we looked at chapter 32, where we were introduced to Elihu. It took Elihu an entire chapter to build himself up to where he is ready to speak. And in chapter 33, he gets down to the meat of his first speech. You remember that Elihu is disturbed with both Job and his friends. He has complaints against each of them. And in the next four chapters, he's going to be talking about those complaints. In chapter 34... He's going to talk about the fact that God is not silent. In chapter 34, he's going to talk about the fact that God is not unjust. In chapter 35, he's going to talk about the fact that God is not uncaring. And in chapter 36, I guess it is, he's going to talk about the fact that God is not powerless. So Elihu, in these next chapters, in his speeches, is going to be addressing the problems that he has with both Job and his friends. This morning we'll look at chapter 33, maybe get into 34, we'll see how things go. And Elihu speaks that God is not silent. In verses 1 to 7 of chapter 33, Elihu emphasizes that he is a mortal himself, just exactly like Job is. He, like Job, has been formed by the Spirit of God. And yet, even though he is a mortal like Job is a mortal, having been formed by the same God, he will answer Job. Notice, if you will, that as we talked about last Lord's Day morning, Elihu is the only one of the four speakers, human speakers in this book, who calls Job by his name. He begins very politely, "However, now, Job, please hear my speech." Elihu has emphasized that he is young, that he has given way to age and supposed wisdom. But age and supposed wisdom have not found the solutions, and so Elihu now is going to give them the benefit of his knowledge. And he begins politely, "Job, please hear my speech." But along with being polite, there probably isn't any better combination of words to describe Elihu than these two: pompous windbag. "Please hear my speech and listen to all my words. Behold, now I open my mouth, my tongue in my mouth speaks." Elihu is impressed with himself. We've already talked about his "I and my" problems. And now, along with that, he is urging upon Job his words as the fount of all wisdom. Furthermore, he says, I am the ultimate expression of sincerity. My words are from the uprightness of my heart, and my lips speak knowledge sincerely. Let me ask you a question. Maybe I'm the only one that does that. Maybe it's an occupational hazard, being a lawyer and being a litigator. But when I'm examining, cross-examining witnesses, and they start asserting, oh, listen, I'm really telling the truth. I'm really sincere. Does a little flag go up in your mind somewhere? My mind usually says, you know, if this guy wasn't lying, he wouldn't be trying to impress me. He's telling the truth. So I start looking all the harder. As a matter of fact, when I get my witnesses ready for a deposition, that's one thing I always tell them. Don't try and lift yourself up by your own bootstraps and impress on opposing counsel how really honest and upright you are. Just get in there and tell the truth and let that be it. Don't say, I'm just real sincere. I'm just trying to tell you the truth. Because that's going to make him wonder about you. And here is Elihu coming in. Oh, I'm the ultimate expression of sincerity. So you listen to what I have to say. He is a human just like Job. Verse 4, the Spirit of God has made me, and the breath of the Almighty gives me life. Refute me if you can. Ever hear anybody say that? Have you ever tried to refute anybody who says, refute me if you can? The attempt and the accomplishment are often two different things. As a matter of fact, you might as well not even make the attempt, because the accomplishment has already been determined. It will not happen. I'm talking about as a general rule. Refute me if you can. Number one, that says that the speaker says, I'm right, I can't be wrong. You say whatever you want to, you can't refute me. And that's really sort of where he's coming from. Array yourselves before me. Take your stand. Now, that expression, take your stand, is a military term. And in essence, Elihu has said, I'm coming on strong and the battle is joined. You just array your forces against me and let's see what's going to happen. Not any doubt in Elihu's mind as to who's going to win the day and who's going to be standing when the battle is over. But he invites Job to the warfare. Job, you don't need to be afraid of me. Behold, I belong to God like you. I too have been formed out of the clay. And that word formed literally means cut out. Some translations, I think, say pinched. But it emphasizes the fact that like man was made from dust, so Elihu was also made out of dust from God, by God. Behold, no fear of me should terrify you, nor should my pressure weigh heavily on you. Now, you've probably heard folks say, well, now, you don't have to listen to what I say. What does that mean? Number one, it means they're going to tell you anyway. And you don't have to listen to what I say really means you better perk up and listen to what I say. That's reading between the lines. That's the translation that is given in ordinary speech as we understand what people are saying. But he says, you shouldn't be afraid of me, nor should my pressure weigh heavily on you. And beginning in verse 8 then, he challenges Job's claim that he suffers because God counts him as an enemy. That goes down through about verse 12. He starts out here by quoting Job. Surely you have spoken in my hearing, and I have heard the sound of your word. You remember one of our questions about Elihu last Lord's Day morning was, how long had Elihu been sitting there? How long had he been listening? And this verse tells us that he had probably been there a while, and he had been listening a while, because he had heard the words of Job. And here is what he says Job has said. I am pure, without transgression. I am innocent, and there is no guilt in me. Behold, he, that is God, invents pretexts against me, that is Job. He counts me as his enemy. He puts my feet in the stocks. He watches all my paths. Those words are attributed to Job. Now, has Job claimed sinlessness? That's what Elihu is saying here, attributing those words to Job. Has Job claimed sinlessness? The answer is no. He has never claimed absolute perfection. He has, in fact, on occasion talked about the sins of his youth. What Job has maintained from the beginning of the book until now is that I have done nothing that causes me to deserve the kind of affliction and suffering and treatment that God is sending on me. He thinks that God has sent it. He does not understand that Satan is working here and that it is something that God has permitted. But he has not claimed sinlessness. So what's Elihu doing here? He is twisting Job's words. He is taking what Job said and what Job meant and interpreting it as he wishes to interpret it. He is taking what Job said and turning it into what he wishes Job had said. Isn't it always easier to knock down a straw man than it is to knock down a real soldier? Has anybody ever lost a joust against a windmill? Probably not. It's just a whole lot easier to go out and shat a box. It's a lot easier to go into the gym and whip a punching bag than it is to get into the ring and have to deal with somebody who's got a haymaker right. And maybe a good left jab to go with it. And so Elihu is here shadowboxing. He's taking what Job said and turning it into what he wishes he had said. What's Elihu's response to that? Verse 12. He has described his version of Job's statement and Job's charges against God. Verse 12, he denies Job's charges. God is above being arbitrary, as Job seems to have charged God. Behold, let me tell you, you are not right in this. Still being fairly polite, isn't he? What would this statement be if it were stated positively? You are not right translates into you are wrong. And that's what Elihu is saying. You are wrong in this. God is beyond us. God is greater than man. Your complaint may be out of ignorance, Job. But whether it is out of ignorance or whatever, you are wrong. Job says that God is silent. And Elihu says that the problem is not because God is silent. Elihu says that the problem is that Job is not listening. Now, before we start looking at what Elihu says here, beginning in verse 13, let's talk about this statement here, second half of verse 12, 12b. For God is greater than man. Now, keep in mind, if you will, that Elihu has now spent a chapter and a half, chapter 32 and down to verse 12 in chapter 33, and the majority of that has been building up Elihu. Let me tell you, fellas, you're wrong. Let me tell you, fellas, I'm upset with you. Let me tell you, fellas, you've missed the mark. Let me tell you, fellas, that even though I'm young and you are old, you have missed out on wisdom. Usually comes with age, but you've demonstrated it doesn't always come with age. And I'm going to give you the benefit of my knowledge, my wisdom, my opinion, and I'm so full, I am just bursting. Let me tell you this grand truth. And we are expecting. Oh, surely. It is going to be something that we have never heard, that nobody has ever thought of. It's going to be something marvelous beyond description. Our appetites have been whetted. We are ready for Elihu to speak. And here he says, God is greater than man. What a marvelous disclosure. Nobody had ever thought of that before, had they? We are sort of let down, aren't we? But that's Elihu's wisdom. But let's listen as he goes on. God, according to Elihu, beginning in verse 13, has not been silent. He has talked to Job. He has answered Job in two ways. And he has answered Job in order to discipline him. Number one, he has spoken to Job in dreams. God speaks in dreams to draw Job away from his evil course. Why do you complain against him that he does not give an account of all his doings? Indeed, God speaks once or twice, yet no one notices it. In a dream, a vision of the night, when sound sleep falls on men, while they slumber in their beds, then he opens the ears of men and seals their instruction that he may turn man aside from his conduct and keep man from pride. He keeps back his soul from the pit and his life from passing over into Sheol. Did God speak in dreams? Sure he did. He spoke through dreams to Abraham, didn't he? Genesis chapter 15. Genesis chapter 27. Joseph had a dream. Chapter 28, Jacob had a dream. He spoke to dream in, through a dream to Daniel. As a matter of fact, to Daniel and some of the others, he not only gave dreams, he gave the ability to interpret dreams that they had and that others had. And Elihu says, Job, God's not silent. God is speaking. You are just not listening. God is speaking to you, and he's speaking to you so that he can spare you from a worse fate. You think you're in bad shape now, Job. There is a worse fate. He keeps back his soul from the pit and his life from passing over into Sheol. God's purpose, you see, Elihu is saying, is beneficent. He speaks to you for your good. He speaks to you to discipline you, to draw you back from the pit. And there is a fate, Job, worse than that which you are suffering. And that's certainly true, isn't it? Anybody going to argue with Elihu on that point? Don't think so. Not those who know and understand the ways and the things of God. Not those who know and understand that there is a place God has prepared for the devil and for his angels, where those who do not prepare to go to the place that God has prepared for those who love him will spend eternity. A fate worse than bones. A fate worse than sitting on an ash heap and scraping oneself with a piece of broken pottery. A fate worse than losing 10 children. A fate worse than losing all of one's earthly possessions and goods. A fate worse than losing all of one's earthly expectations and glory. And Elihu says God is speaking, and he's speaking for a beneficent purpose, and that is to draw you back. But God speaks through something else, Elihu says. God speaks through affliction to bring you back to repentance. Man is also chastened with pain on his bed and with unceasing complaint in his bones, so that his life loathes bread and his sole favorite food. His flesh wastes away from sight, and his bones, which were not seen, stick out. Then his soul draws near to the pit, and his life to those who bring death. And the purpose is to bring to repentance. Verse 30, to bring back his soul from the pit that he may be enlightened with the light of life. Is there anybody who has never been really, really sick who is unable to identify with what's going on here? So that his life loathes bread. Have you ever been just really sick? And somebody then comes in and says, "Come on in, dinner's ready." And just the thought of dinner being ready makes you run to the bathroom. Where you heave and heave until you dry heave. Now, I know that's not pretty language, but that's what Job is talking about here. Or Elihu's talking about, the book of Job. His flesh wastes away from sight, even his favorite food. Oh, well, yeah, I know Jess is sick, but he'll love this. This is his favorite. Let me tell you, there's a time when even I don't want chicken and dumplings. Not very often. But there is such a time. His soul loathes favorite food. His flesh wastes away from sight, and his bones which were not seen. Yeah, he looks healthy. He got flesh on his bones. You heard that? And then you've heard the opposite. Well, he's just wasting away to nothing. His bones are sticking out. And that's what Elihu is describing here. The man who is so sick that his flesh has wasted away and his bones are sticking out. Now, notice something. Is there a difference here between what Elihu is saying and what Job's three friends have been saying? Job's three friends have been saying, "Yeah, Job, you're sick, you're in bad shape, but you are suffering and you are enduring all of this that you are enduring because of your sin." Elihu comes along and he says, "Yes, Job, you're sick and you're suffering. Yes, Job, you have lost everything that is near and dear to you, but it is because God is disciplining you. God is preparing you. God is bringing you to repentance." The implication of sin is there, but it is God working to bring restoration. He attributes the suffering to God, but for restoration. Does anybody doubt that suffering can be a wholesome experience? Shouldn't. It can be a wholesome experience if it causes us to take the right action based upon the right reaction to it. Proverbs 3:11 and 12, quoted in Hebrews 12:5 and 6, tells us not to despise the chastening of the Father, because whom the Lord loves, He chastens. But what's the problem here? The problem here is that Elihu's position is based upon the premise that God is judging Job, and that having judged Job and seen the problems and the sins in Job's life, God is sending the affliction to bring Job to repentance. And the problem is that God is not judging Job at all. That's not what is causing it. You and I know that. We have, as we have said on numerous occasions, the ability to see behind the scenes here, that neither Job nor Elihu nor his friends had the ability to see. But maybe you and I need to learn a lesson here. And that is that we, without an ability to see behind the scenes, except as God has disclosed it to us, as He has here in the book of Job, need to be fairly slow in reaching conclusions about why something is happening to somebody. That might have been good advice for Elihu. Would you agree with me that when a believer has lost 10 children, when a believer has lost all of his or her worldly goods, when a believer is lying upon an ash heap of affliction and suffering, that it is a poor time to go in and say to that person, "Boy, God's really getting you"? That sort of goes through our mind, doesn't it? One wonders how far we have come from the disciples of Jesus, who, seeing the blind man, said, "Lord, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" Wonder what he did to be suffering so. Jesus said, "Neither did this man sin, nor his parents." Now, was that true? Don't you reckon that man and his parents had sinned? I certainly do. What's that? The Jews certainly did. Not much doubt about it. They weren't perfect. But there was a grander scheme involved. Jesus was not even saying that this man had this blindness afflicted on him so that I could cure him. Jesus was simply saying this didn't happen as a result of sin, but it is an occasion for people to see the glory and the work of God. Just let God work it out. What people need at a time like that is not some kind of lesson in theology. What they need is for somebody to love them. What they need is not some kind of fancy theological explanation. Let me explain to you why this is happening. My favorite illustration is this. We've got some mamas and some young babies here. And some of us, on our good days when the blood's getting to our head, can still remember when we had young'uns. And it comes time to bundle them up and take them down to the doctor. And they're sitting there on that table, as cold as it is, just a gooing and a cooing and a smiling. And then all of a sudden, some mean, old, good-for-nothing doctor or nurse slips up behind them and goes, whoop, and gets them with that needle. And that smile goes away, that mouth flies open, those lungs and that throat go to work, and you've never heard such a blood-curdling scream. And I guarantee you, there's not a one of these young mamas here, or those of you who were mamas of those little ones years ago, who just stood there and said, now, child, let me explain to you why that's happening. Wasn't the time for explanations. What you did was get that little baby and take it up in your arms and hold it and love it. And pretty soon the pain went away because somebody loves you. And when we see our brothers and our sisters going through pain and suffering, it's not a time for us to give them some kind of fancy theological explanation. It's not a time for us to say, now listen here, let me explain what happened and why. Let that be a lesson to you. Yeah, let that be a lesson to you. It's a time for us to take them in our arms and love them. But here's Elihu. And he's saying, Job, I know you're hurting, but let me tell you why. God's getting you. And God's doing it. He's doing it for your good, Job. Just like the shots for the good of that little baby. But he's trying to do it to straighten you out. God is speaking, Elihu said, Job, you're just not listening. Sometimes God speaks to us most plainly in our pain and in our suffering. C.S. Lewis described it well. He said, God whispers to us in our pleasures. God speaks to us in our conscience. God shouts to us in our pain. Pain, he said, is God's megaphone to rouse a deaf world. That's sort of well said, isn't it? All right, the first bell. I'm getting so good at this. The first bell has rung. And we are at verse 23. And we will continue at verse 23 next Lord's Day morning. And I'm going to ask you a question. Now, there were some members of this class who embarrassed me greatly this morning by asking me at the end of the class last week, as you looked at the coming chapters, I asked you a question, something to be looking at. And there are two members of this class who shall stay nameless, although their initials are Marion Williams and Bill Ellison, who had the audacity to ask me this morning what that question was. Said they didn't remember. I didn't either. But in case you remember, and in case I remember, the question for next Lord's Day is that in verse 23, Elihu speaks of a mediator. What does Elihu mean? To whom or to what is Elihu referring? Tune in next week. Same time, same station. Thank you for your presence and your attention this morning.